On today's special edition of Rooster Teeth Reviews, we're talking to the man behind Nomad of Nowhere. It's a special interview episode of Rooster Teeth Reviews. Don't go anywhere.
You're tuned in to AfterBuzz TV, the ESPN of TV talk. Now, let the buzz begin.
Hello, citizens of nowhere and wherever you may come from, the four corners, the iron border, whatever you want to call it. This special edition of Rooster Teeth Reviews, I'm one of your hosts, and it's Mark Bidonica, but we are joined by the man behind Nomad of Nowhere, the creator of it. I'm really excited to have him on. This has been a long time coming. We've got Jordan Whitman on the line. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning.
How you doing?
Pretty good. How about you?
Absolutely excellent. It's been a thrill. I know we didn't talk too much at RTX, but how was it seeing the fruits of your creation sort of in real life in 3D as opposed to 2D on the page?
It was wonderful. It was very nice. It's always good to see just being a part of it, and it's kind of like you don't really realize it's happening also at the same time. You're kind of in disbelief sitting there, but it's wonderful nonetheless.
I'm excited to see what other RTXs, now that season one has wrapped and we have sort of more of an idea of more of this world, how much more colorful the cosplay community is going to be, and especially with just the amount of nomads and critters and things that were just littered around. I think if people showed up to RTX for any other reason, they left with a fair idea of what Nomad of Nowhere is. It's so cool to have that experience. Before we sort of jump straight into Nomad of Nowhere, I just wanted to know a little bit more about your animation sensibilities. What was your earliest memory involving animation?
Like my earliest, like when I really wanted to go into it?
Yeah.
It actually started around like high school. I started doing machinima and directing for the Big M company. And that's like kind of when it started kicking in. I actually saw Monty Ohm's like Haloid and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, wow, that's really cool. I really want to do that. But at the same time, I didn't want to learn 3D programming. So I was like, I should learn how to draw. So that's when that really kind of picked up. And I went to art school and I taught myself how to draw. And then I really wanted to tell a story. And that's kind of where it all started.
What did you use to machinimate?
I used Halo.
Okay.
Specifically. Yeah, it was just perfect. The Forge and stuff I loved.
Was there any sort of a series or a movie that really struck you when it came to storytelling as opposed to more just the art form?
You know, Roger Rabbit was probably my biggest inspiration and still is. Roger Rabbit is something that's like, I love the hybrid of the live action and animation, but just like the handling of everything in that movie is just gorgeous. And it's like, it's just a fun movie and a nice trope on the old classic cartoons. I love it.
And what was your favorite classic? Was it, going into Roger Rabbit, were you more of a Disney shorts or a Disney animation or Warner Brothers guy? Like what camp did you sign up for, so to speak?
Probably more Disney, but I also loved like the Warner Brothers stuff. Like I love Looney Tunes and I love Chuck Jones, especially Chuck Jones, but I'm everywhere. Like I love it all. Animation's just so pure, especially 2D. I love so much.
It's the best. And you bring up a fair point about Chuck Jones. There are only a few animators that even people in the industry tend to throw at. There's a lot of skilled people around the industry, but even more casual fans go, ah, well, if it wasn't Chuck Jones, then I wasn't as into it. So it's just, I keep hearing Chuck Jones coming back around, and it's just a great confirmation. They even had, well, didn't they have the Chuck Jones show on Cartoon Network back in the day?
Yeah.
Where they just featured Chuck Jones stuff. That was the best. Do you have a favorite animated character? Some character that you either identify with or no matter what they do, it's the best.
You know, probably like, I gotta say, like, even my favorite movie is like WALL-E, just because I love silent protagonists, as you can clearly see. And that's something that's a form of storytelling that's just wonderful. If you can convince and like really hook an audience without having to say anything, like that's magic. Like that's wonderful.
I think that's also why people tend to gravitate towards the Coyote and Roadrunners too, is they have such
a
dynamic relationship. And despite it, it seemed like the only times the Coyote would speak was when there was another speaking character in it. So like the Bugs Roadrunner Coyote ones, but just distill it down to those two and it's pure comedy, pure character, pure everything. Yeah, I love me some Wally. I haven't seen that in years. I should go back and watch that. But in this world where we're just, I won't say battered, but we have plenty of remakes and reimaginations. Is there anything that you would want to see brought back? Is that the sequel to Roger Rabbit that's been rumored for years and years? Or is there like a little hidden gem, a little concept that you don't think got its due time in the sun?
Probably, like, do you know Thief and the Cobbler?
Yes, I do know Thief and the Cobbler.
But, like, it wasn't, like, done. Yeah, I'm glad you know, but it's like, it was never finished. And it's like, that's something that's, I mean, it was, but at the same time, it just felt like it wasn't what he wanted it to be. And I would love to see that. Like, that'd be a dream thing, of course. Like, I don't know if it'll ever happen, but that's something that's beautiful.
Have you ever seen the cobbled cut?
I think so. That's the whole one, right?
Yeah,
that's everything. Right?
That's where it's pencil tests and non-color and sort of the director's cut of an animation movie, which we don't necessarily get all the time. But yeah, the cobbled cut is sort of what, quote, Thief and the Cobbler purists point to and go, no, that's the movie that was supposed to come out, not the one that we got. But yeah, that style was so interesting and so dynamic. And yeah, hell of a good call. So you created a short called Sir Knight of Nothing. Can you share the process, where this character came from and start creating a short with what means you had at the time?
Yeah, I was in college at the time and I knew, like, I was an illustrator and they didn't really like people outside of animation doing animations because they were never finished. But I was like, I really want to step up to the plate, and my good teacher Teal was like, you're never gonna do it. But like, he meant that in a good way, but like, he was very good in pushing. And I went forward. I was like, you know, I'm gonna make the animated short, like, I'm gonna finish this and it's gonna be good. And the process to making Night of Nothing, like, there was a lot of like changes that happened along the way. Like, originally, like, there was a king instead of like the big eagle angry dude, and he was like the one that was just trying to get people to get the crown for him. Mm-hmm. And I changed that up, and originally, like, the whole place, like the whole silence thing, like, actually took place in, like, there's a really darker turn where it was like kind of supposed to all take place in limbo, and all of it was like he's already dead. Mm-hmm. And there's a big, deep, like, weird thing going on. And then eventually I kind of just was like, you know what, I'm just going to simplify this, make it charming, sweet, short. And it is what it is, and then it kind of turned into what it is now, like with the knight and the crown, and then that all kind of comes around again later.
You bringing up it was going to go deeper in this and that, I think that might have been where that misconception of, oh, animators never finish their shorts, that might be something that went into it, is just, no, we got to make it bigger, we got to make it greater, but that ambition and that drive just to always do more and do bigger is a great one to have. What was your support structure like? How many animators did you work with on it? Was it just you, or did you lead a team?
I had so for the most part, it was myself, and my girlfriend also helped me at some wonderful points. But for the most part, I did a large majority of the work. It wasn't until the very end, when like time was really of the essence, it was near the end of the year, I needed to have it done. And I brought on some wonderful like freshmen of the school, and they helped do in between colors and stuff like that. So like, I had the animation all there. They just had to like use the paint bucket tool, and I was like, please fill this. There's too many frames and scenes. I can't do it all. And they did wonderfully, and I gave them like free art and stuff for it. And I tried to compensate them and stuff, and they were very nice, and I can't thank them enough too.
Where did the concept of the helmet holes, eye holes being the mouths come from, and was that inspired by anything?
You know, it's funny. It's actually, that probably came from Machinima in a way. It's like, I watched Red vs. Blue and stuff, and you know, the head bobs and mm-hmm. stuff. And I was like, you know what? I don't want to do a lip sync. And I was like, I was sitting there and I was like, how do I convey it? And I was like, oh, kind of like Machinima, the head bobs. But then halfway through, I was like, what if I just make their eyes and lip sync? And I was like, you know what? Like, let's just see how it looks. And it was really interesting. And like, so that's what I did, is I just made the helmets the actual lip sync instead. And it worked, like, and so long as I paced it properly.
Yeah. And it added, sort of with Silent Protagonist, how important the eyes are when it comes to expression. It just added that extra layer on top of, oh no, this is exactly what they're saying, and we're seeing it with their eyes, and we get a chance to hear it as well. So it added to how super expressive animation can be. And so being in a situation where you got to get it done, you got to get it done. We do have a lot of animators and budding artists that watch the show. I'm sure everybody's heard this question and gotten this question a lot, but I always want to ask it when I can, because everybody's story is different. Do you have any tips or advice for people who are coming up, especially now that the internet has made the community a lot more close knit? Is there anything any advice that you could offer?
You know, like, I always hear, like, I've gotten a few questions recently about, like, how do you make a show? Like, what goes into it? Like, how do you start? And the biggest thing is, like, just really starting and putting pen to paper. And I, like, if you have an idea, make a pitch Bible, make a pilot, like, with a storyboard with some friends and stuff. It doesn't have to be, like, a full animated short. It doesn't have to be everything's done. Like, just have something ready to prepare and show people. So maybe you can bring it somewhere someday, and then if they really love it, then they take off. And if it's not working, then you fix it and you can go back to it and keep reworking. And it's everything's a progress. And so it's like, everything takes time. Everything is, but it's worth it. Like, I love doing it. It's like, that's the reason I do it. And I recommend, if anyone wants to do it, I hope they love it too. And that's the biggest thing.
Mm-hmm. And you bring up Story Bible, which has little to nothing to do with actual drawing at all, but just world building. And yeah, when it came to building the Sir Knight of Nothing, Nomad of Nowhere world, what was your most sort of grandiose vision that didn't make it into the final cut?
I guess, like, I'm trying to think. There are a few things that I was like, oh man, that's kind of sad, then make it in. But, like, at the same time, I was like, yeah, it's no big deal. I'm trying to think. There, you know, there was, like, a sequence in Nomad of Nowhere that I was like, oh man, like, I kind of wish it played out like this. And this is just, like, fantasy, like, nothing.
Yeah,
like,
just as a viewer.
Spectacular or anything. Yeah, this is just me. This is just, like, oh man. But there's a moment, so it's sort of in replace of, like, the whole where Redmond Well bumps into Scout down the taverns and stuff like that. Like, originally there was, like, this, like, little thing that I worked out where instead of that, and Scout sort of being with him in that moment, she instead made the initiative to sneak out of Don Paragon's place and go and see him. And so, like, she, like, went out to, like, go find him personally. So they had more, like, one-on-one time, and she got to, like, ask questions, and he tried to answer them without really being able to, but it sort of built a bond. Mm-hmm. And at one point I had this whole thing where I was like, what if Paragon or Toss sort of catches her coming back one night? And it's like that she's kind of conflicted and being like, oh, what do I do? Like, do I throw in the person I love, or do I report it and for the people, basically, and for my job and my loyalty? Mm-hmm. And she ultimately does that, and Paragon sort of, he's reported, like, he's told about it, and he looks at Scout and goes, like, oh, well, she mentioned something about, like, remember in episode 2, he says, like, Scout's like, oh, he's very empathetic, I don't think he's that bad, he's like, oh, we can use that against him, and it's like, that's where it clicks, and he takes Scout captive and sort of puts out these flyers for some, sort of like a ball, basically, that he's throwing in honor of knowing that the Nomad's going to come, because he's like, his only friend is in danger, he's gonna come. So that's like sort of what he uses as bait and then lures him in. And that's the only difference, is like, it was just something where it's like using his empathy against him, and I was like, oh man. But at the same time, I love the way it turned out. Like, it was perfect, like, it still works.
Yeah,
good. But that was the fantasy of, like, oh well, that didn't make it, but whatever.
You bring up Toth and Scout. We got a confirmation that they were, we seemingly got a confirmation that they were LGBT characters without overtly turning to the audience and saying it. But were they always planned to be so?
Yeah, they were always in my pitch Bible. And it's for a reason. Like, there's, and I'm not going in spoiler territory or anything, but it's like from the start, like when I brought like the little outline forward of like who these characters are, like what they stand for, like, they were always that. Like, they were like, Toth is too proud to be able to say like that she has feelings for someone, and Scout's too afraid to say it because it's who she is. And so, like, that's where that kind of awkward quarrel and entanglement comes from between the two. And in my really, really early, like, small storyboarded pilot for Nomad of Nowhere, there was, like, a sequence. It was just, like, a sequence in the woods, sort of like episode one where they're looking for him. And that's where I really decided, I was like, you know, these two characters, like, that's when I first made Scout and Toth. I was like, these two characters, like, they mean a lot to each other. But how do I make it so, like, at the end of season one, we see they kind of go their separate ways. But I was like, how do I make it so they keep coming back to each other? Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't want it to be like, oh, best friends. I was like, no, it has to be love. Love is the thing that's going to keep bringing these two back. And it's like, that's also going to cause a lot more tension and a lot more conflict. And so it's like, it's story-based too. It's story-driven. And that's like, that's sort of the thing that's going to keep coming back in Nomad, is like these two characters. They do. It's clear, like, that these two characters love each other. Mm-hmm. And they want to make it happen, but they're dealing with something that makes it difficult to do it. They're dealing with their jobs. And so, like, that's kind of the tough part.
Work-based romances, right? Like, how well do those ever turn out? Where did Scout and Toth come from? Was there any sort of an inspiration from your life? I know you mentioned on Twitter that Melinda was sort of inspired by your mother and her love of Harry Potter and magic and things like that. Is there anybody from your life that inspired Toth and Scout?
You know, they were kind of more so based on a little bits and pieces of myself in a way. It's like, everyone says, write what you know. Mm-hmm. And Scout and Toth is like, Toth is the voice in your head that's always just like, do it. Like, what are you doing? Like, just like kind of like hitting you upside the head when you're too afraid to do something. And Scout is very much the opposite. She's like the rational side of thinking, and the side that's like, you know, maybe before I taking a step, I consider the consequences and I sort of try to think what to do. And those two opposites attract each other, and they very much speak to each other very often, at least like when I'm thinking. And it's like those, that's where they kind of based off of and where those attitudes came from. So their actual designs and stuff, like, I was just like, you know, I really want these two to be interesting and appealing, and I just kind of started drawing a lot of different stuff until they finally stuck.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very cool. And you mentioned a little bit that the scene with Red Manuel. Did Red Manuel come from anywhere in particular? Were you?
I think he was Eddie. I think Eddie said that he came up with Red Manuel. And you know, in all honesty, it's like when I read Red Manuel, I was just like, I know everyone loves him, but personally, I was like, I don't know how I feel about him.
Ultimately became a really divisive character, and not until you really saw past, or we were shown past just the sort of toady ass kisser, brown noser type of character, and you finally saw him in action and his purpose, you're like, oh, I get him, I understand him, and everything else makes sense.
And that's like, that's why I love like that. That's why I love like that final line that he gives when he realizes he's a total person. I was like, wow, this is kind of almost fourth wall breaking for like even writing the character himself. And I was like, that's such a really nice touch. And like that, I really like that.
Yeah. We were lucky enough to talk to Eddie about it and to talk to Alejandro about it. And everybody just by the end of it was like, oh, poor Red Manuel. It's like, yeah, but he still shot our lead character.
Yeah, exactly.
What the hell are we talking about here? While we're talking about inspirations, how much did the Nomad character change from the Knight, if at all? And what was the inspiration behind the Nomad?
So I love, like, this is a fun little story. Mm-hmm. So originally the show was called Knight of Nothing. That's what I pitched it as. It was supposed to be medieval. This is like, the entire thing was written out. Instead of Don Paragon, it was Lord Paragon. Instead of the governors of the Four Corners, it was the guardians of the Four Corners. And it's just like, just slight differences, like, in all honesty. And then Rooster Teeth is coming out with a show. It's being made at the same time. It's been announced now as Motor Knight. And he's like, Miles comes up to me one day, he's like, hey man, there's another medieval show being made. It's like, if you could make this into anything else, what would it be? And I was like, and I literally, like, it kind of clicked, like, all in that moment. Like, I was like, you know what? It'd fit as a Western. I was like, it's cast Samurai Jack like right now, but it would fit as a Western too. And I was like, there were Trigun influences early on, even when it was medieval. But then when it became a Western, I was like, okay, now it's really clear. the exchange of that was, like, literally, I went home, like, that night, and I was, like, looking at the pitch doc, and I was like, I have to change everything. And, like, I kind of, like, I was like, I don't know what to do. Like, I started panicking, and I was like, you know what? No, I don't. I was like, all of these characters stay the exact same. The only thing that changes is the environment. And I was like, but how do I make that change intentional? Like, how do I make this environment into a Western with it being reasonable and logical within the world? And I don't know if I can dig into that, like, right now, but there's a reason for it. There's a reason why the world is a barren wasteland. Mm. And there's like, it's, and it works. Like, and honestly, it works better, in my opinion. I think it was a change that was a last minute thing, but it was a wonderful one. Like, it was something that was like, I remember, like, late night, even I was, like, sitting there, and I was like, we were reworking the pitch document. I was working on some art and stuff for it. And Miles was sitting next to me. He's like, what do we do for, like, Paragon? He's like, it's Lord Paragon. What's a more Western thing? I was like, he's like, he, like, looks it up, and he's like, Dawn. And, like, he's like, he wrote it down. It's just like, it rolls off the tongue now, Dawn Paragon. And it's like, yeah, that's perfect. And he changed it to, like, governors and stuff. And, like, it was wonderful. Like, it was like a really good, like, moment. And it's really nice.
Yeah, that's cool to hear. I was wondering, because we've talked before about El Rey and the Crown and things like that, and I had wondered if the through line was straight to El Rey, and if there were any if Dawn Paragon existed early on, if the governors existed early on. That's a really delightful story, given the circumstance of we have to change everything. But,
I'm not opposed to ever change. Like, it's always something that's like, you know, you gotta figure it out, and it's like, that's part of the challenge, and it's part of the fun of it too. It's like, change isn't always a bad thing, and it's like, there's ways to do it.
And I mean, it seemed to be a pretty quick and easy change, at least with some of the wording, and then we adjust here and there. And speaking to the we've talked about it a little bit on the Nomad show of what El Rey sort of represents, and this idea of the Nomad being about creation and El Rey being about consuming, and especially sort of after how the show or how season one ended, there are ideas there, you know, if you think deep enough, okay, everything is starting to make sense. And, there's some interesting, fourth wall messaging that you can pull from it as well. That's really, really nice. How much did change when it came from Lord Paragon to Dawn Paragon? Did anything really change? Because
not really.
When it comes to foppish characters, he's one of the best.
Oh yeah, I Dawn Paragon was definitely like an inspiration of, like, I was listening to like Hamilton and stuff at the time, and like the King George and stuff like that. Like, I was like, that's exactly, like, I was like, I want him. And I wanted I originally wanted, like, Justin McElroy to voice him, like, the taco voice I loved, and, like, stuff like that.
Dude, that would have been sweet.
And, like, I was like, I love that kind of character. Like, someone who's just all of themselves, but also at the same time, it's just, like, has some competence in terms of, like, business making, in terms of, like, dealing. Mm-hmm. And he's not a big, big bad, but he's just a nice, like, mini boss to, like, get through the way before you start dealing with a lot worse things. And he's, like, he's a nice ramp up. Like, he's a nice, like, little, like, softball before you start playing, like, major league. And that's basically what he is. He's always been that way. He didn't change very much, honestly. Like, we ran through, like, a few different ideas at one point. We were like, oh, what if he was, like, a bullfighter or whatever, like, had like the whatever that costume kind of thing is.
Yeah.
And like, we dabbled with a few different things. But one thing, like, I that really stuck, I think, was just the whole, when it turned to a wasteland, I was like, well, what's a business in a wasteland? Like, what's the most important thing? And I was like, water. And so, like, that's when it became an oasis of sorts, and became like, that's what it was.
That's interesting to hear that there was almost a bullfighter aesthetic. Now, with the reveal of Governor Toro, that visual would have created a completely, like, a completely different dynamic without having to say a word. That's very interesting.
And he, Toro was a lion originally. So mm-hmm. when he was medieval, he wasn't a bull, he was a lion. And then I was like, all right, I got to change this because lions don't make sense. But, I mean, they kind of do, but like, I was like, I want it to be something more kind of Western-y. And I was like, a bull, like bullfighting. And mm-hmm. like, I was like, the ring and the Colosseum, or the Colosseum is what they call it. And I was like, that's where interesting things and dynamics like come in. And I was like, yeah, that's fitting. And, I guess like something I want to say is like, so in my little like document I handed over, it's like there was a lot in there. Like it was basically what I guess now would be considered like kind of almost two seasons worth of like stuff, mm-hmm. and then the ending of the show, which is like that's something that I think is written there. I mean, Rusty, they get to do whatever they want, but it's like it's a wonderful thing right now, and you know they're doing a wonderful job, and mm-hmm. so that's we'll see where it goes. But that's yeah, it's interesting. Like it's I'm very excited.
So you in talking about Toro and being a lion, you seem to have always had an idea of magic in the world. If it doesn't give away too much of what you handed over, and what we could still possibly see, what was your original idea for the scope of magic? How readily accessible was it to the populace?
I mean, it was always known that at the start of the story, that the nomad is sort of the one who's the target right now and mm-hmm. is the one holding a lot of it at the very least. And as well as like kind of the governors is what we saw with episode 6, like, Elray kind of gave them a little bit of something. So he has the ability to give stuff. Mm-hmm. But he also has the very strong ability to take. And it's like, that's the question. It's like, how much of this wasteland is still empty and how much of it is like, how much of it is in him. And it's like, you have to think, it's like, this dude is like God tier basically. Like at this point, like in the story, like this dude has everything from how much he's consumed. And it's like, that's not spoiling anything. That's just kind of like, that's the speculation. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's what makes him terrifying. And it's like that. Yeah. I mean, that's what really brings together is you're dealing with a nobody versus someone who has everything. And it's like, that's sort of the main theme.
Yeah, we talked about on the show just the power gap, the huge power gap between a Don Paragon and an El Rey that we got to see in episode 12. We've been on a bit of an emotional roller coaster when it came to the show and Eddie teased it with those specific words. But is there anything that you can preview from the docs that you, well, you've said that you're excited about certain stuff. Is there anything that you want us to watch out for without sort of overstepping? And I know that's a very difficult question to tiptoe around.
Sorry, say that one more time.
Is there any sort of a preview that you can provide for at least what you've given into the, yeah. to the network?
I mean, like, your speculation is pretty on par. I mean, I'm not going to go into detail on anything, but it's like, it was certainly designed to be a show that's like, oh, look how happy and nice this is. And then it turns into real life. And it turns into, like, not everyone is nice. Not everyone plays fair. And, you know, it's like, things happen and life has to go on when things happen. It's like, I'm not going to say anything beyond that.
Sure, sure.
It's like, it certainly isn't, I mean, I don't know. Like I can't really dive too deep. But
no, of course not. But that's a great.
it's dark.
I really like that description of everything's bright and happy, and then life happens, and yeah. you have to continue. I think that's a great message to impart. We did get a little bit of the origin brought into the story with the Knight and the Witch episode. Did you have anything to do with the design? Was that flashback a part of the original docs that you submitted, or is that something that they threw in?
Yeah, nope, that was all in there. Mm-hmm. The flashback was always intended to like go back to the medieval and the evolution and stuff, like I was saying earlier. Mm-hmm. That episode especially was always in there. My hopes, and it's one of these things that's like, ah, well, but it's fine. I originally was really hoping that would play out later, And specifically because it's like, okay, we now know he's a scarecrow. It's like, we know what he is. And I wanted to see like a lot of like foreshadowing with crows early on and stuff, like just more things to like really make it clear where it's like, crows don't look at scarecrows. Crows are afraid of them. There's a reason why this guy has been so hard to find for so long. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's kind of like the message. And you know, I wanted to play out later just because it was, I wanted breadcrumbs, you know, I really wanted something for the audience to really pick up and being like, what are you? Like, cause at the end of season one, I almost wanted a moment where Dom Paragon like sort of stabs him and like, you're like, what? Like, and he gets back up again, like kind of like the gunshot and stuff like that. And it's like, what are you? And that's when you have the questions or the audience are asking, what is he? How does he act? Cause now we have to play with, or at least, from what I get an understanding, it's like, now that we know what the Nomad is, the question is now how do we not only hurt him physically, but like mentally, emotionally, like that's the next step. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, he's very strong. Like he can cut off a limb and it can march back towards him. So now you have to start messing with him in different ways. And like, that's kind of as much info as I can give.
Definitely. Like once, I was reminded, especially just because of the sound effects of, there's an episode of SpongeBob where he's confronted by a bully and is like, ah, I'm going to beat you up. But he's built out of sponge so he can absorb all of that stuff. And then and when it comes to the Nomad, now it's, well, we can't, like you said, we can't hurt you physically. What else can we do? And the notion of that is absolutely terrifying because
absolutely. It's worse. It's a lot worse.
Yeah. Everybody identifies with the Nomad as their cinnamon bun, their son, all sorts of things. There's such an affinity to this character and everybody's latched on to Nomad, to Scout, to Toth in certain situations, and even have a little bit of a love for our quote villains, like the Dandelions or Don Paragon or Red Manuel. And only when we were even Toro a little bit, because he just seems so nonplussed about everything. But the second that everybody was introduced to El Rey, everybody sort of emotionally grabbed on to the Nomad and went, don't you hurt my son ever again. Go ahead.
And
there's
a bit of a darker tone behind even like just the Nomad. And I want to point it out just for people to realize where it's like, this is a character that can't talk. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, when something really emotional and painful happens and like you want to cry or yell or scream, it's like that eats up at you over time. And that's kind of something that I can like kind of put out there. And it's like, that hurts and it ramps. And when you can't say anything about it, it's like that's psychologically, it's messed up.
And we also saw a little bit in the Undertaker episode where we have this person just berating, and you can't say anything to retaliate. You can't do anything because you're locked up. And ultimately that expression of emotion had to be anger. So I think now that the Nomad has to deal with people that can communicate through speech and any other means, that the Nomad has to learn new ways to communicate as well, which I think presents another interesting caveat to this character another hurdle that we have to climb. But I wanted to ask, since a lot of these characters have immediately hit home with the fandom, do you have anything to say to the Nomad of Nowhere fandom?
Just keep hoping. It's like, that's like, I hate to like leave it kind of ominous like that, but it's like, there's a lot of people like earlier on in the season, like, wow, it got dark. And I was like, that's not dark. And it's like, there's like moments where like, it's stuff like that, or it's like, just keep, like, that's sort of the message of the show, is it's like, just keep moving forward, like keep hoping. And it's like, that's sort of the tone. And so that's, we'll see. But I thank them every day, like the Nomad fandom, and they're wonderful. And it makes me so delighted to see everything and the interactions, especially like shout out to Eruption Fang and stuff. He did a a little like breakdown of like the where it started and stuff, and it's like that was very nice of him to do that and mm-hmm. stuff. And
yeah, the even the crew, like we've had Molly Flood on, who absolutely just we throw Nomad memes back and forth at each other,
yeah.
and randomness and concepts, and so like even just the this character has really hit home at a time where everybody kind of needs that hope, and the Nomad at least is a representative of that light and that brightness that the world tends to need at its darkest times. Not implying
yeah,
too much, but and we wouldn't have gotten that without you, without the night. So thank you for bringing this character into the world, because oh boy, did the world need it.
Well, thank you guys for loving it so much, and I'm happy it worked out at the right time. Like mm-hmm. I certainly saw, like as I was like making the Bible and like writing things down, I was like, man, things are just getting worse. This is fitting all the better. And like it was one of those things where like I was like looking around at like society and stuff, and it's very much like a thing where it's like El Rey's tyrannical and stuff like that, mm-hmm. where the Nomad is the people's man. Like he's the common man, and it's kind of like. I don't know, like society shifting and stuff, and it's interesting. It's fun.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the echoes of our society when it comes to the wasteland. Before we let you go, I really wanted to point out you're working on something new, and I was wondering if there was anything that you could tell us about it or how that process is going.
It's going really well. You know, I'm working on a. What will hopefully become a new series or show that'll hopefully be picked up. But right now we're working on the pilot, and it's something that's very special to me. It's based off of my childhood and based off of sort of like an adventure between me and my sister growing up, like in Cape Cod and stuff. And it's very, I don't know, like I don't want to go into too much detail right now just because like it's something that's kind of still under work.
Sure.
But it's something that's very meaningful to me. And it's something that has a lot of things that you'll even see like with Nomad, like a lot of morals and a lot of lessons and a lot of hard life stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think makes the good stories is the characters you can relate to as a person and learn from too. It's like, that's why I love cartoons. I grew up and I watched cartoons and I was like, wow, like this is what it means to be a good person for this character. Like this is what it means to not be a good person with this character. And it's like that's the whole point. And you take it and you apply it to regular society, and it helps and it works. And that's my hope, is that I can tell a story that will help people. And that's what I want to do.
And what's it like getting back into the I guess I could call it the pitch Bible mind mode? Like how much time are you spending working on this versus giving yourself time to sort of breathe and be apart from it?
So there was a few months like where I took a little bit of a breather, but I've been working on this one actually prior to Nomad.
Mm.
This was one that came up in college with me and my friends, Kevin Temer and Charlie Parisi. And we all sat around a table and I had a dream one night and I was like, I have to do this. And I wrote it down. And it all sort of started there. And it is very much like a folk tale of sorts, almost, I don't want to say over the garden Wally, but it's like, it's something that's like, it's abstract in a way, but it's also very real. And it's something that's where it started, was years ago, actually. And then I kind of brought it back after I did Nomad, because when I was doing Nomad and why I brought that forward, I was like, this Nomad was a test for me. I was mm-hmm. like, this is the drop in the bucket. I was like, let's see if people like this. And then if they do, hopefully this next one will be even like something that's really touching and powerful. And that's the hope for this one now.
That's a great way to put it. I'm really appreciative of your time. We did have a couple of people watching live that had a couple of, well, let me, I'll not ask that question because it's a little silly, but we had somebody in chat, unfortunately their name I can't pronounce, that asked, where did you get the idea for the bouncing animated objects? So for the critters, like
critters.
Where did that come from?
That actually came, so when I decided, like, the whole thing, El Rey was the start of the magic, like, mm-hmm. that's, like, the whole short, like, with the crown and stuff like that I made, it's, like, that's where it started. It's, like, that crown has a very significant, like, even in my short, like, it's, like, there's a link, and it's, like, that's where the magic started.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I was, like, well, what do I give the Nomad or the Knight at the time? What do I give him to make it so this journey is doable? Otherwise, he's just like this Charlie Chaplin dude running around. And I was like, what's the thing? And like, eventually I kind of stuck. I was like, I love Full Metal Alchemist and stuff like that. And I was like, I want something like clapping. And that's like what I always tell like Alphonse and stuff like that. They did the clap and they hit the ground. And I was like, I want to do something like that. But what does it do exactly? And then I came up like bringing inanimates to life was the thing that like really stuck. And something that doesn't move. And the reason the rock stuck is because I was like, well, those are the most inanimate things of all, so they're the easiest to bring to life. And then I put little googly eyes on them, and they were adorable. And Miyazaki, of course, is a reference, like the soot. Like, I love, mm-hmm. like, all that. And that's what I kind of inspired from.
Well, cool. Thank you. The silly question that I'll ask anyway, just because, will you hurt us again? Which is just a silly, silly thing. Cause of course you will. But, go ahead. Sorry.
It's gonna hurt. No, it's just like, yeah, like again, like write what you know. And El Rey is certainly a part of like, El Rey is sort of the part of me that like thinks outside the box. It's like, how can I hurt the audience as much as I possibly can? Oh, and it's like, that's what El Rey is. It's basically just that.
Just El Rey, a constant reminder of pain. Great.
Yeah.
Well, even to the point, something that I don't know if it was a design decision or not, but something that I noticed in rewatching the show before we did our season recap in episode one, the first book that Scout pulls out has a yellow circle and a Roman numeral 1, which looks just like the damn El Rey eye, which just crushed me emotionally to the point where I was like, I don't know if I can watch the show and not find eyes everywhere. Because didn't you post a picture of the wanted poster, and it has the El Rey eye as the wax seal?
Yep.
And like before,
it's always there. Like, keep looking. Like, there's more. Like, people haven't found some yet. Like, I, as an artist, it's like I threw an Easter egg I didn't even tell anyone about. I was like, I'll see if people find these. And it's like, that's certainly one of them. I designed that book to be an eyeball. It's like that. They're all in there. Like, at one point, I didn't do this, but I did contemplate having like in the background. Like, I did like a painted background. I was like, what if I put Morse code or something like in the, like back, like dots and dashes, and like had it read like El Rey is watching and stuff like that. Like, just really like push like the fourth wall. And like, I was like, no, I'm not gonna go that Gravity Falls with it. I'll just
yeah, start introducing ciphers, and all of a sudden there's a pyramid in the background with an El Rey eye. Like, just that's a lot. Damn, now I'm kind of scared to go back and watch the show again. But is there anything else that you want to bring up before we let you go? This has been a gas, and I had a hell of a time.
Yeah, so I'm baffled no one's really caught it yet, but there are certainly Easter eggs, even in Camp of Nomad of Nowhere, before the show is even made. And I'm like sitting here and I'm like, I wonder if anyone's going to catch these. And it's like, there are things that like I put in, like even the knights in an episode, and like, there's good luck finding them. Like, that's just Easter eggs. Have fun hunting.
Well, just knowing the layout of Camp Campbell, the only place that the knight could be would be in Campbell's secret house or a summer home.
Or someone that maybe likes to play Dungeons and Dragons.
Or Neris. Okay. All right. I'm going to rewatch Camp in its entirety again. But cool. So now we have that mission, and we've put that mission out into the world. Jordan, thank you so much for spending some of your time with us and shedding a little bit more light into the world when it comes to this character and the show. And I'm looking forward to whenever we see what comes next from you.
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Not a problem. If anybody wants to follow you on Twitter or any sort of stuff that you want to push or anything like that, now's the time. Please feel free.
Sure. At Jordan_Whitman. And it's my name is spelled weird. It's Gordon. And that's the hard part. After that, Whitman, underscore Whitman. There you go. That's the follow in place.
And nailing it. Thanks again, Jordan. Talk to you soon, and hope everything goes well with you. Thanks again.
Thanks so much, and you too. Have a good one, guys.
Thanks, Jordan. That was absolutely delightful. Well, now everybody has to go back and watch Camp Camp. Everybody has to go back and watch Nomad of Nowhere. We haven't heard any sort of a confirmation about season two, but it's been really popular. So let's keep hoping. Let the folks at Rooster Teeth know that you want to see more Nomad of Nowhere. We got to see where this darkness takes us. Make sure you follow Jordan on Twitter at Jordan_Whitman. Make sure to follow us at AfterBuzzTV, at The Rooster Team. TeePublic.com/TheRoosterTeam as well helps support us making all of our independent content as well. We'll be back next week for another episode of Rooster Teeth Reviews. But until then, I've been your host, the Internet's Mark B. Donica. You can follow me on Twitter at Mark B. Donica and on Twitch at twitch.tv/TheInventoryFullPT. We'll see you next time.
Our founder, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and me, Maria Menounos, would like to thank you for tuning in to AfterBuzz TV. Remember, we're not just the first, we're the biggest in the world, and we're the only destination for all your favorite TV shows. Whatever you crave, we've got it. So go to AfterBuzzTV.com and check out our lineup. Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.